Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. This 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. On the show today, our reporter Phil Dierking goes to prison, sort of. Phil tells about a music program at Sing Sing Prison in New York. The program is helping prisoners get a new start on life. We also hear another segment of a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. Writer John Irving is the subject this week. And we close the show, as always, with an American short story. Today, we hear part one of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane. But first, this news from the world of sports. Soccer's international governing body, FIFA, is investigating reported racial abuse by soccer fans in Russia. The top international soccer competition, the World Cup, is to take place in Russia in less than 3 months. The reported abuse took place Tuesday during a match in St. Petersburg between the French and Russian national teams. During the game, people in the crowd reportedly yelled a racist term repeatedly at black players from France. The yelling was captured by television cameras. It reportedly can be heard clearly after Paul Pogba scored France's second goal. France won the match 3-1. FIFA said on Wednesday that it was collecting evidence and would contact the anti-discrimination organization Fair Network. The group helps FIFA investigate reports of racism. A FIFA statement said the group is collecting evidence connected to the incident. FIFA said it could not comment further until it had considered all the evidence. French Sports Minister Laurent Flessel commented on Twitter, "Racism has no place on the soccer field," she wrote. "We should act together at a European and international level in order to stop this intolerable behavior." Fair Network said the incident in St. Petersburg shows the weaknesses in Russia's preparations for the World Cup. Piara Poar is head of Fair Network. "If photographers heard it pitch side, then there must have been stewards and other officials who also heard it," he said. He said it will be a bad sign for the World Cup if officials do not have a plan by the end of this month to deal with racist fan behavior. He said, "So close to the World Cup, questions are being asked to why it wasn't dealt with as it occurred during play." This latest incident of reported racism is the third this season at St. Petersburg Stadium, which is to hold a World Cup semifinal match. The other two cases involve the city's local team, Zenit. The United European Football Association begins to hear one of those cases May 31st. The World Cup is to start 2 weeks later.
Sing Sing Correctional Facility is a high-security prison about an hour by car north of New York City. Sing Sing holds 1,600 prisoners. As the men serve their sentences, prison officials are planning for the time those detainees will be released. One of those officials is Leslie Mallon, the deputy superintendent for program services at Sing Sing. Mallon says the prison offers technical training and educational classes. It also has a music program, which works in partnership with New York City's Carnegie Hall Fine Arts Center. Two times a month, artists from New York go to Sing Sing and spend a day working with the 30 detainees involved in its Musical Connections program. The program is 9 years old. Before that, Sing Sing had just a music room. A man identified only as Rob is a former prisoner. New York's Department of Corrections asked that VOA not give any last names of prisoners. Rob remembers there were often fights over who could use the music room, but he said it was hard to hate the other men when they are helping each other with music and performing songs. Rob has been on parole for the past year and a half, after spending 7 years in Sing Sing. He says he performed just two times before he went to prison. A man called Joe had even less experience. I didn't know what an A-flat was, he admits. I've heard these terms. I couldn't have explained them to you. I didn't know what they sounded like. I didn't know what they meant. Joe spent 4 years in the Musical Connections program. He studied music theory during that time. Now, Joe is writing an operatic work. He said he became interested in classical music after working with opera star Joyce DiDonato. She definitely opened my eyes to something that I didn't even know I had within myself, he added.
Here in this place, it's a sin to be me.
Kenyatta, who has been in prison for 23 years, calls the music program the most transformative thing I have ever experienced. Kenyatta earned a master's degree after completing a higher education program in religious studies. He has been a speaker in a TED Talk video from Sing Sing. Kenyatta has been a part of the music program since it started. He says music has helped him open up to others. I can be a little less alone, he says, because I know you understand some part of me, at least, and you can be a little less alone because you know that I understand some part of you. The Musical Connections program is under the direction of Carnegie Hall's Manuel Bagoro. He leads similar programs in homeless shelters and community centers. Bagoro says all the programs have similar goals. He says people have come together. They play together. They negotiate artistic decisions. They sort out problems. And those are all the skills that prisoners can use when they are out of jail. Danny was released from Sing Sing 3.5 years ago, after 7 years in the prison system. He learned to play the violin in the Musical Connections program and started writing music. Danny said that after his release, he was able to take the same energy and effort required to learn an instrument and put it into other areas of his life. One of the teaching artists, Sarah Elizabeth Charles, says she has seen both personal and musical growth in the prisoners over the years. I just think the sky's the limit for so many of the men in this workshop. They're professional. They're working. Many of them are working on the level of a professional musician. Yes, sky's the limit, she says. Carnegie Hall holds a monthly gathering for the program's members who have been released from Sing Sing. Rob says that at these meetings, the men do more than play music. They also talk about what's going on in their lives. He told VOA, "It showed me that everybody was struggling, trying to find a job, trying to stay employed, trying to find some time to practice. I knew I wasn't alone in any of these things." I'm Phil Dierking.
Host Alice Winkler is next with What It Takes from the American Academy of Achievement. Writer John Irving is the subject this week.
I'll begin where I always begin, which is at the end. I've never started to write a novel or a screenplay without knowing the ending first. And I don't mean that I need only to know what happens at the end of a novel or a screenplay before I begin. I need to know the sentences themselves.
But I need to start at the beginning. That voice belongs to John Irving. He's one of the finest and most widely read American novelists of the past 50 years. The World According to Garp, A Prayer for Owen Meany, The Cider House Rules, all his, and most recently, Avenue of Mysteries. Five of his novels have been turned into movies. Before we return to the story of John Irving's approach to writing stories end first, I need to say, this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler. I interrupted John Irving with my introduction. He was starting to explain how he never begins writing a novel without knowing first what the final sentences will be, which, if you think about it, is a little mind-boggling. So picking that back up, here's John Irving speaking in New York to an international gathering of Academy of Achievement delegates in 2005.
I need to know what the words are and the atmosphere that those words convey. I need to know how melancholic a story this is, how uplifting or not. It's like an end note to a piece of music. I can't imagine where the reader should jump into the story if I don't know where I'm going first. This is an aspect, my wife tells me, of my over-controlling nature. But I am a believer in the novels of the 19th century, a plot-driven, character-based novel where the passage of time is almost as important or as important as any of the major minor characters in that story. The passage of time and the effects of the passage of time on the people in that story. In The World According to Garp, we are all terminal cases is the last sentence of that novel, but it was the first sentence I wrote. You've got to get obsessed and stay obsessed. You have to keep passing the open windows was the first sentence I wrote for the Hotel New Hampshire. But I knew it was the end of the novel. It was the pep talk, the anti-suicide language at the end of what was a suicidal novel.
In the case of The Cider House Rules, it was a benediction, a tender phrase that the doctor at the orphanage says to the orphans every night as he turns out the light.
Princes of Maine, kings of New England, they're anything but. They're orphans. Nobody wanted them. But he says this to make them feel better.
That line, princes of Maine, kings of New England, isn't just the last line. It's a refrain repeated several times in the novel, a technique John Irving is very fond of and compares to the repetitions you find in any long piece of music, in an opera or a soundtrack. John Irving's novels are always long, and his stories famously complicated. He says the process of researching and note-taking and mapping typically takes him 18 months before he begins writing, but always those final lines are on a postcard tacked to the wall. Because what he is doing is reconstructing the story from the back to the front, as he says, until he knows where the front is.
The atmosphere at the end of a novel, if I don't know what it is, how do I know I want to spend 5 years making that journey? If I don't know that there isn't something that is an emotional kick at the end of that story, why am I going to invest the time? The novel I've just finished took 7 years. That's my longest, and I hope I don't do that again. But believe me, I never would have started if I didn't know that there was something emotionally gratifying enough at the end of the story. Why would I take the time? At the end of The Fourth Hand, a man who's lost a hand and a woman who's lost a husband are making love in a Green Bay, Wisconsin hotel. We don't know what the future holds in store for them or for people like them, for people who've lost things. People are always losing things in my novels, not always comically, but sometimes so. This ending was on another postcard for 2.5 years. Outside their warm hotel, the cold wind was a harbinger of the coming winter, but they heard only their own harsh breathing. Like other lovers, they were oblivious to the swirling wind, which blew on and on in the wild, uncaring Wisconsin night.
To hear the entire What It Takes podcast on John Irving, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
From VOA Learning English, this is American Stories. Our story is called The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. It was written by Stephen Crane. We will listen to the story in two parts. Today, we will hear the first part of the story.
The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. The great train was rushing forward. Such steady dignity of motion that a glance from the window seemed to simply prove that the flatlands of Texas were pouring toward the east. A newly married pair had come on this train at San Antonio. The man's face was reddened from many days in the wind and sun. His roughened hands were continually moving over his new black clothes in a most nervous manner. From time to time he looked down respectfully at his suit. He sat with a hand on each knee like a man waiting in a shop for a haircut. The glances he gave to other passengers were few and quick. The bride was not pretty, nor was she very young. She wore a dress of blue with many buttons. She continually turned her head to regard some part or other of her dress. It made her feel strange. One could tell that she had cooked and that she expected to cook dutifully. The searching glances of some of the passengers as she had entered the car had brought the blood rushing to her face. Her uncomfortable expression was strange to see upon this plain face, which was usually calm and almost emotionless. They were evidently very happy.
"Ever been in a train like this before?"
he asked, smiling with delight.
"No," she answered. "I never was. It's fine, isn't it?"
"Great. After a while, we'll go forward to the dining car and get a big dinner. Finest meal in the world. Costs a dollar."
"Oh, it does?" cried the bride. "A dollar? Oh, that's too much for us, isn't it, Jack?"
"Not on this trip, at least," he answered bravely. "We're going to enjoy ourselves."
Later, he explained to her about the trains.
"You see, it's 1,000 miles from one end of Texas to the other. The train runs straight across it and only stops 4 times. He had the pride of an owner. He pointed out to her the beauty of the car they were riding in.
And in truth, her eyes opened wider as she observed the rich sea-green cloth covering the seats, the shining silver and glass, the wood that shone darkly like the surface of a pool of oil. To the minds of the pair, their surroundings repeated the glory of their wedding that morning in San Antonio. This was the spirit of their new life, and the man's face in particular shone with a joy that made him appear foolish to certain passengers. In the minds of some, there was supposed to be something hugely funny in the pair's situation. "We're due in Yellow Sky at 3:42, he said, looking tenderly into her eyes.
"Oh, are we?"
she said, as if she had not been aware of it, to show surprise that her husband's remark was part of her wifely duty. She took from her pocket a little silver watch. As she held it before her and stared at it with a look of attention, the new husband's face shone. "I bought it in San Antonio from a friend of mine," he told her proudly.
"It's 12:17,
she said, looking up at him with a happy expression which, nevertheless, showed a lack of experience in conversing with men. A passenger, observing her small nervousness, laughed to himself. At last they went to the dining car. The man serving their table happened to take pleasure in directing them through their meal. He viewed them with the manner of a fatherly guide, his face shining with kindness. But they did not understand his attentions. As they returned to their seats, they showed in their faces a sense of escape. It was evident that, as the distance from Yellow Sky grew shorter, the husband became more nervous. His red hands were even more noticeable. He was rather absent-minded and far away when the bride leaned forward and spoke to him. As a matter of truth, Jack Potter was beginning to find his deed weighing upon him like a great stone. He, the town policeman of Yellow Sky, was a man known, liked, and feared in his community. He, an important person, had gone to San Antonio to meet a girl he believed he loved. And there he had actually married her without discussing any part of the matter with Yellow Sky. He was now bringing his bride to a sure-to-be-surprised town. Of course, people in Yellow Sky married as it pleased them, but Potter's thoughts of his duty to his friends, or of their idea of his duty, made him feel he was sinful. He was guilty of a great and unusual crime. Face to face with this girl in San Antonio, he had leaped all over the social fences. At San Antonio, he was like a man hidden in the dark. A knife to cut any friendly duty was easy to take in his hand in that distant city. But the hour of Yellow Sky, the hour of daylight, was approaching. He knew very well that his wedding was an important thing to the town. It could only be equaled by the burning of the new hotel. His friends could not forgive him, he felt. And now the train was hurrying him toward a scene of surprise, merriment, and blame. He glanced out of the window again. Yellow Sky had a kind of band which played its horns and drums painfully to the delight of the people. He laughed without heart as he thought of it. If the citizens could dream of his arrival with his bride, they would march the band at the station and accompany them among cheers and laughter to his house. He decided that he would use all methods of speed and cleverness in making the journey from the station to his house. Once safely at home, he would announce the news. Then he would not go among the citizens until they had had time to master their emotions. The bride looked anxiously at him.
"What's worrying you, Jack?"
He laughed. "I'm not worrying, girl. I'm only thinking of Yellow Sky." She understood, and her face turned red again. They shared a sense of slight guilt that developed a finer tenderness. They looked at each other with eyes softly glowing.
but Potter often laughed the same nervous laugh. The deep red color upon the bride's face did not lessen.
"We're nearly there," he said.
As the train began to slow, they moved forward in the car. The long line of cars moved into the station of Yellow Sky.
"The train has to get water here," said Potter from a tight throat and face, as one announcing death.
Before the train stopped, his eye had searched the station, and he was glad and surprised to see there was no one there except the station master.
"Come on, girl," said Potter with a thick voice.
As he helped her down, they each laughed in a strained manner. He took her bag and told his wife to hold his arm. As they hurried away, he saw that the station master had turned and was running toward them, waving his arms. Potter laughed, and sighed as he laughed when he realized the first effect of his wedding upon Yellow Sky. He grasped his wife's arm firmly to his side, and they hurried away. The California train was due at Yellow Sky in 21 minutes. There were 6 men in the Weary Gentleman's saloon. One was a salesman who talked a great deal and rapidly. 3 were Texans who did not care to talk at that time, and 2 were Mexican sheep farmers who did not usually talk in the saloon. The saloon keeper's dog lay in front of the door. His head was resting on his feet, and he glanced sleepily here and there with the ready watchfulness of a dog that is sometimes kicked. Across the sandy street were some bright green grass spots, so wonderful in appearance next to the burning sands in the hot sun. At the cooler side of the railroad station, a man without a coat sat in a chair leaned back against the building. He smoked his pipe. The waters of the Rio Grande River circled near the town, and beyond it could be seen great flatlands. Except for the busy salesman and his companions in the saloon, Yellow Sky was sleeping. The salesman leaned easily upon a table and told many tales with the confidence of a storyteller who has found new listeners. He was interrupted by a young man who suddenly appeared in the open door. He cried, "Scratchy Wilson's drunk, and he has started to make trouble." The 2 Mexicans at once put down the glasses and disappeared through the rear door of the saloon. The salesman, not understanding the importance of the warning, jokingly answered, "All right, old man, suppose he has. Come in and have a drink anyhow." But the information had made such an apparent impression upon everyone in the room that the salesman was forced to see its importance. All had become instantly serious. "Well," he said, filled with mystery, "what is this?" His 3 companions started to tell him, but the young man at the door stopped them. "It means, my friend," he answered as he came into the saloon, "that for the next 2 hours this town won't be very healthy." The saloon keeper went to the door and locked it. Reaching out of the window, he pulled in heavy wooden boards which covered the windows and locked there. The salesman was looking from one to another. "What is this, anyhow?" he cried. "You don't mean it's going to be a gunfight?"
Come back to American Stories next week for the second half of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane.
That's all the time we have for the show today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you'll join us then. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.